From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The UN Security Council Thursday was urged by UN Humanitarian Coordinator Stephen O'Brien to encourage the warring sides in Yemen to return to the bargaining table. Fighting between Yemeni forces and a Saudi-led group seeking to reinstall former President Abdurrabah Mansour Hadi has killed more than 6,000 civilians, most of those victims of Saudi air attacks, which have been pounding the country on a daily basis for the past year. Hadi, running unopposed, was elected to a 2-year transitional term in February 2012. Although his term formally ended in March 2014, he held on to power until February of the following year, when protesters surrounded the presidential palace, holding him under virtual house arrest. He resigned and fled to Saudi Arabia. Once there, he rescinded his resignation and declared himself still president. He was recognized shortly thereafter by Riyadh. Despite the fact that in 2012 his candidacy was backed by the ruling party as well as the parliamentary opposition, last year Hadi's own party, the General People's Congress, said that they would not accept his return to the presidency. The Saudis began bombing a few days after that announcement. Peace talks were due to resume this past January, but the Saudis refused to meet and a new date has not yet been set. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
Civilians in Yemen face daily relentless and indiscriminate shelling and bombing, according to Mr. O'Brien. The humanitarian chief said more than 2,000 children have been killed since the start of the conflict. 90 have been killed so far this year alone. He spoke to the Security Council via video conference from Brussels.
Once again, I underscore the urgent need for this council and the international community more broadly to impress upon the parties to this conflict their obligations to take greater measures to protect civilians, to facilitate unconditional and sustained access to all parts of Yemen. And I also ask the council to press the parties to resume peace talks and agree to a cessation of hostilities.
Mr. O'Brien said the UN and its partners continue to support millions of desperate citizens despite challenges. Last month, over 3 million Yemenis received food assistance, nearly 500,000 more than in January. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
This month's president of the Security Council, Ismael Gaspar Martins, who is the permanent representative of the Republic of Angola, spoke with journalists following the closed session.
Good afternoon. I think we can talk. Let me say that, as you have seen, the council has just ended its deliberations on Yemen. The council expressed a very grave concern about the dire situation and called for allowing in unimpeded work of the humanitarian agencies. This was our main focus, the humanitarian situation, which is extremely grave in Yemen, and the call on the member states to respond to humanitarian appeal, called on the sides to comply with international humanitarian law, expressed grave concern about the increased activity of ISIL and Al-Qaeda in Yemen. We reaffirmed full support to the work of the Special Envoy of the Secretary General, Ismail Olcheikh Ahmed, who is doing a marvelous work under very difficult circumstances and making progress. We reiterate that there is no military solution to the conflict, and stress that a speedy cessation of hostilities, which would allow to improve the humanitarian situation and help advance the political process. Without this, we would not be able to really deal with the grave humanitarian situation. So cessation of hostilities, it's a must. And called for a speedy resumption of the talks between the parties towards comprehensive settlement of the conflict. So basically, these are the messages that we can convey to you coming from the Council. The Council is united on this. If it were a resolution, it would be again adopted as a unanimous, because this is a unanimous position and firm position by the Council members. I can now take a few questions. I'm ready.
During the session, have there been any discussion about a draft resolution for a humanitarian situation in Yemen? And in your view, do you think it's necessary to have such a resolution about Yemen?
With the situation which is prevailing in Yemen, yes, a resolution might be a necessity, maybe even speedy one, because the situation is evolving towards a very drastic one, with the bombings continuing on hospitals, killing children in schools. So it's a dire situation, and we cannot remain blind to a situation which is evolving before our eyes as a very dire situation.
Ambassador, you talked about a speedy resolution. Was there any timeline given for when you'd start to move forward? And also, did the special envoy give a date for when he'd like to resume talks? Last time he was here, he said he hoped for talks by mid-March. Is that still possible?
Yes, we discussed this. The talks will be coming soon. I think he's making all the necessary preparations on the consultation that he is undertaking with the countries involved also in the Gulf. And I think sooner than later we should see that resumption coming of the talks.
So yes. What about the resolution? Sorry. Or when will you be moving forward?
The humanitarian resolution, let me say that we discussed this already last month. It was discussed again today, as you see, right, second day of our presidency. This is on the table. So I think this is also a product that should be coming soon as we finalize our negotiations.
Mr.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. I just wanted to first clarify what Whitney asked about the possible timetable for a resumption of talks. Was the special envoy still talking about mid-March as a target date? And you also said that you expressed serious concern about the increasing spread of the Islamic State group. Did he give any examples about whether it's spread, how far it's spreading, how much of the country is now controlled, and what was the council's reaction? Because we hear that the control by the Islamic State is really spreading quite dramatically.
Well, I cannot give you a specific indication as to the size of the area controlled by the Islamic State, but it's a growing spread, fast also, given the inexistence of a real governmental institution. Where you have a vacuum that is occupied by someone, and they are exploiting that a vacuum which unfortunately exists in the country. This is why it is important for the negotiations to start, where the parties can agree on the governance that is needed to avoid the continuing existence of a vacuum which is again is producing this. It's growing. It's a real concern. The Islamic State, the problem is that this is in a region where there is already a situation which is of a concern to the Council. So that's all I can say.
Mr.
Please.
Thank you. My question will be about Palestine.
About?
Palestine.
The Caliphate.
Palestine.
Palestine. Yeah. Oh, please. Okay.
Yeah, the Security Council is engaged in discussing humanitarian issues in Syria, Libya, Central African Republic, Iraq. But the Security Council seems to be ignoring another humanitarian disaster in Gaza, which has been under siege for 8 years. Yeah. Do you have any initiative? Would you consider holding a special session to talk about the humanitarian situation in Gaza in particular?
All right. I fully sympathize with what you're saying. We did not discuss this morning, but the situation of Palestine, in Palestine, the humanitarian situation in Palestine, as you know, is on the agenda of the Council. So in the Council, and the Council is free to look at it at any time, which might also be done sometime during the month of March. But we did not discuss it this morning specifically. Thank you.
Can you specify on the humanitarian resolution? I'm not sure I understand what the humanitarian resolution would say, going beyond what has been said from the Security Council on that issue.
Well, one of the key problems with the humanitarian situation, and this is also coming sooner, is the targeting of healthcare, be it civil society or international, which is again rendering the situation much more difficult than it should have been. So the resolution will deal with this, will deal also with the necessity for the international community to respond more effectively to the very growing dire situation and needs. Yeah.
On the WFP ship, I wanted to ask you, Undersecretary General O'Brien had said that there was a ship that was diverted by Saudi Arabia into Saudi Arabia, that the ship was released, but still the humanitarian IT equipment is going to be released, and he said he's pleased. I wanted to know whether the council discussed this practice of, in terms of, we're talking about sieges and other places, of blocking humanitarian aid and especially keeping this equipment behind, and whether there's any sense of the council that it shouldn't happen again. Is it normal to keep it back? And I guess that's my question.
Okay. Well, we did not talk specifically about this instance that you are mentioning, but we have discussed the need for clarity as to the possibility of keeping Djibouti and the port as the center, and for an agreement to be reached with all the stakeholders as to where the ships would come, who should decide on whether what they are bringing is needed, and move all those goods or whatever, especially if it is food and medication, to the needed population. I think I've covered all the points. Thank you very much. Thank you. Merci.
With Republicans and Democrats wrangling for position for the November election, and with the constituencies of the various candidates duking it out in social media, one issue that's not being discussed very much is the possibility of the election being stolen with rigged ballot boxes. For more on that, we spoke with an expert, Harvey Wasserman, via telephone Thursday. Harvey Wasserman, welcome back. It's a pleasure, as always.
God, it's an honor.
You point out in the midst of all the other wrangling about these elections that the vote's probably not being counted right either. You want to talk about that some?
Well, it comes down to this. There is no verifiability of the electronic vote count. It's as simple as that. About 80% of the votes in the coming presidential election of 2016 will be cast on electronic voting machines across the United States. Now, these voting machines were mostly bought with money from the Help America Vote Act, which was passed in 2002 as a response to the fiasco in Florida in 2000. But as a result of that, most of the machines in the United States on which people will be casting ballots are 10 years old. I don't know how many of your listeners are working on computers that are 10 years old, but they're all completely obsolete. And because they're electronic, and they're privately owned, and the courts have ruled that the software is proprietary, there is no real way to verify the electronic vote count. Now, people want to come at you and say this is a conspiracy theory. Just ask them, okay, how do we verify the vote count? And you will get a blank stare because it can't be done.
Right. And you know what's interesting about it? When they're arguing exactly the opposite against Apple right now for the right to crack their technology.
Yes. And, you know, it's an outrage. And I will tell you, Don, that I'm a Green. I'm in the Green Party, so I'm not partisan interest in the Democrats or Republicans. But the reality is that the Republicans in this coming election have the governor and the secretary of state in six key swing states where the election could be decided at midnight on election night with the governor, the secretary of state, and an IT person. And they could flip these entire states in 60 seconds or less, no matter how the people voted. And we're talking about Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Iowa, and Arizona. All six of those states have a Republican governor and a Republican secretary of state with the vast majority of votes being cast on an electronic voting machine. There's absolutely nothing to stop them from flipping those states, you know, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning on election night. The modus operandi usually is, you know, the votes are coming in and the networks are panting and everybody's going crazy. And then all of a sudden, there's a glitch. They announce a glitch and there's a stop in the flow of information. And then a couple hours later, we emerge with a different winner. This is exactly what happened in 2004 in Ohio. And it's happened in many Senate and governor races since. And it happened to us in the, we had a marijuana referendum in Ohio that we believe was flipped. So this is the flip part of the strip and flip election of 2016.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that, I remember 2004, Kerry was going to challenge it if it happened with 95 lawyers, and then he sat on his hands and all of that. And the Greens, you guys had to bring a lawsuit, actually, and to try to just get some public view of what actually happened. But even assuming, say, the Democrats decide to challenge this stuff aggressively, is the wherewithal all there, legally and, in terms of IT, to reconstruct the actual voting?
No, there's nothing they can do. It's all electronic. It's all in a black box. They can't get access to the software. Let me tell you, Don, in 2004, the state of Ohio denied me my absentee ballot. I've lived in the same house since 1986, for God's sakes. Voted in the same place. They wouldn't give me an absentee ballot. So I joined in the class action lawsuit, the King Lincoln Bonneville lawsuit, which Bob Fitrakis was the lead attorney, my co-author, right, on our upcoming book. And we won, for God's sakes. We won in federal court. And the federal judge, Algernon Marbley, ruled that the 88 counties in Ohio were required by federal law to produce all the records from all the voting in the 2004 election. By then, we had a Democratic Secretary of State, Jennifer Pruner, and she set up a repository in Columbus ready to receive all these materials. And when time came, 56 of the 88 counties in Ohio said they had nothing to bring. They did not have their records. One county said that it got mistakenly put in the recycling. One county said that a coffee urn spilled on the Scantron ballots. It was ridiculous. So there was never a recount. An independent recount done in 2004, which we know was stolen. And John Kerry, as you mentioned, had an army of lawyers, $7 million. We informed his people, we knew his people in Columbus, that Bush was allegedly winning by about 130,000 votes. It eventually turned into 118,775. But at the time, on election morning, the morning after the election, we made it clear to Kerry's people that 250,000 votes were still uncounted. And at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, he conceded. Jeez. He had $7 million. He had an army of lawyers, and he went windsurfing. And he has never said a word since.
So you can expect the same sort of behavior now. In addition to that, you have interesting primary contradictions, you know, the contradictions between the some of the candidates, the two candidates with mass movements of one kind or another behind them, and the leadership of each of the two political parties. So the entire apparatus for protecting the integrity of the vote or the incentive to corrupt the vote or miscount the vote, it's in a very strange place right now.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Bernie Sanders won the caucuses in Iowa and Nevada. They're totally rigged. I mean, I've talked to people who were there. It was ridiculous the way they did the voting. I don't believe Hillary Clinton won those caucuses in any way, shape, or form. And if Bernie had come out with victories in those two caucuses, the picture of the race would be much, much different. So there is no doubt in my mind that they are stealing it from Bernie. And, you know, that's what the Clintons do. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, it was very funny. There were rumors, there were reports from Texas in this last Republican primary that votes were flipping. People who were voting for Trump, their votes turned up for Rubio.
Right.
But, you know, that would be funny. We enjoy that kind of thing.
The other interesting thing about it is looking beyond the out to the conventions, beyond the actual voting, you have had this, you know, you have this massive discontent in the electorate right now, whether it leans left, right, in like a totally inchoate ideological thing going on, like nothing. All kinds of individualized ideologies, maybe, and candidates that are, you know, coming out of those, out of that condition. Two of them, Sanders and Trump, and the party apparatus looking to push both of them out. What do you think will happen to those groups if they're locked out of the electoral process by what appears to be developing?
Well, Don, the strategy is pretty clear. The center. The two establishments, which I guess Mitt Romney's getting in today or is going to do something today.
Yeah.
And Hillary, of course, you know, represents the corporate Democrats. You know, they are terrified of Bush on the right. I'm sorry, of Trump on the right and Bernie on the left. And I think that Bernie has a pretty coherent message. Mm. Trump is a traditional fascist strongman. I mean, he's like Mussolini, not quite as bad as Hitler, but very similar to Mussolini in a lot of ways. Mm. You know, it's all about him. And we Berlusconi also in Italy, similar to him.
Yeah.
Big money and big ego.
Yeah.
Bernie, I think, delivers a pretty clear ideological message. And he won four states on Super Tuesday. Mm. A little depressed he lost Massachusetts, but I'd have to look closer at that.
Right.
So I think you're going to see that the center is really going to try and regroup. And I will guarantee you that if Hillary gets and Trump are the nominees, that a lot of the really big Republican corporate money will go to Hillary. I mean, they've got no argument with her. She's a permanent war candidate. She's a corporate candidate. It'd be nice to have a woman in the White House, just like it was nice to have an African American with Obama, but politically, it's not going to mean much. So, but they were terrified of Bernie. They still are. He's done a great service. You know, he's aroused a generation of students and young people. He's been very clear in his message. He's been a great candidate, far, far superior to anything we could have imagined, really. And we owe him a great debt, I think. But there is no doubt. Well, let's put it this way. As Bernie points out, the economy is rigged, right? The election finance is rigged. Why wouldn't they take the tiny extra step to rig the voting machines?
Right.
I mean, these voting machines are completely vulnerable. And they can totally be hacked. We've had numerous public demonstrations of people hacking these voting machines. Somebody got on one of the voting machines and played Pac-Man, for God's sake. I mean, these things they're ridiculous. We need universal hand-counted paper ballots. But in this election, Don, we have a challenge. Bob Strakis and I are trying to set up a website. We want to get people to, in many states, they are required to post the results on a sheet of paper on the window of the precinct. Now, there's about 100,000. We estimate there's about 100,000 precincts in the country. And we would like to see how many people we can organize, certainly in the swing states, to get digital images of the vote count at the precinct. It's a little hard to manipulate at the precincts. I mean, it can be done. Obviously, it has been done. The real flipping is done on the statewide electronic vote counting. That's what they did in Ohio 2004, and they messed with it also in Florida 2000. So
yeah, they can scatter those across all of the precincts that way, and they're not so detectable.
Yes, it's a lot easier. So if we can get the Herculean task of getting digital images of all the postings and all the precincts, they're required to do it in Ohio, and we don't know what other states they're required, but if we can focus on the swing states, maybe we'll be able to have some kind of check. I mean, the reality, Don, is Germany, Japan, Ireland, Canada, and Romania all have universal hand-counted paper ballots. And in Germany in particular, the vote count, the actual vote count, correlates with the exit polls within a quarter of a percent. Now, here in the United States, what they do is when there's a big discrepancy between the electronic vote count and the exit polls, they adjust the exit polls. I mean, you know.
Yep. All right, on that note, we'll leave it there. Harvey, thank you very much. Harvey Wasserman, solartopia.org. Always a pleasure.
Yes. And Don, our new book coming out probably within the month, and we'll give you a copy. It's called The Strip and Flip Selection of 2016, Five Jim Crows and Electronic Election Theft. So we'll talk to you about that when it comes out.
Required reading for as early this year as people can get their hands on it. Some say that it almost doesn't matter who counts the vote or how it's counted, or even if it's correct at the end of the day. Those people say that the real show isn't the presidential election, but rather structural collapse of the entire system. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford spoke with Professor Anthony Montero from Philadelphia via telephone this past week.
One hesitates to always use the word crisis because we overuse it, but we're in something of a serious, serious political crisis. You know, it's not just Trump, it's Bernie on the left side, and each of them, although Trump is closer to Wall Street and the ruling class than Bernie is, but each of them have followings that are set up with the old manner of doing things, but have not yet discovered what the new will look like. So I think we're probably at the end of a historic epoch of two parties, probably the post-World War II epoch of politics in the United States is coming to an end at this time. So a 70-year cycle has ended.
Would it be unfair to talk about a crisis of legitimacy of both political parties and therefore of the duopoly system itself?
No question about it. You would have to call it a crisis of legitimacy. And it is one of those crises where the ruling elite cannot rule in the old way, the old duopoly two-party system, and the people increasingly are not going to allow themselves to be ruled in the ways that they have been. So something new, perhaps, is about to be born.
The pressures on the Democratic side against the established duopoly seem to be coming from the young white side of the party.
Yeah, it is. At least that's who was out in front of this, kind of like with Occupy Wall Street. And, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement is a next stage of the Occupy Wall Street movement. But I would not rule out the growing numbers of young black people who are attempting to find their way to the Bernie Sanders movement. I think that's very good stuff, and I think it bodes well for the future. Now, the obstacles in front of young black people are probably greater than for any other demographic in the political equation. But I think, in spite of the black Democratic Party politicians and the preachers and so on, that we're looking at young people who are going to find their way to Bernie Sanders or to this movement, which is bigger than Bernie Sanders and I think is going to last longer than Bernie Sanders.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.